I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Wade Davis joins me now. He has written an astonishingly absorbing book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. It is a remarkable book about the generation of explorers who set out to conquer Mount Everest just after the First World War. For many, the British especially, getting to the top of Everest had been an obsession going back to the latter part of the 19th century. George Mallory, the most conspicuous of the adventurers, is the one most recalled, as his death on the mountain in 1924 in his third expedition has been the source of legend and speculation even after his body was recovered in 1999. In this gripping book, Wade Davis not only explores Mallory's life and times, but also the others on the expedition, who were almost all veterans of the war. They'd seen the horrors of the conflict, yet they undertook this adventure to forget that which they had seen, and also as a sort of grand imperial gesture for the fading empire. These were people shaped by a world war in a world that was soon to be reshaped by another. Wade Davis is the best-selling author of more than 12 books, including The Wayfinders, One River, and The Serpent and the Rainbow. He is an anthropologist and is National Geographic's explorer in residence. He divides his time between northern British Columbia and Washington, D.C., and joins me from Toronto this day. The book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Wade Davis. Good morning, Mr. Davis.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, it should be pronounced Everest, right? Or Everest?
Well, that was the name. George Everest was a family name, or Everest was the family name of the man who was the head of the Survey of India, for whom the mountain's named. It's one of the ironies of history that he was a bit of a curmudgeon, and a mountain that bears his family name has been mispronounced for all time.
Yeah, yeah. The interest in well, we'll call it known as Everest. The interest in that began when for you in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I was actually traveling in Tibet as part of an ecological survey in 1996 when we. We traveled 4,000 miles from Chengdu in western China through to Lhasa and on to Kathmandu, and we happened to pass the mountain just as the disaster happened that John Krakauer so powerfully chronicled in his book Into Thin Air.
Yeah.
And the very next year, I was back on the east face of Everest in the Gama Valley at the base of the Kanchung face, trying to photograph snow leopards and further down the valley clouded leopards with a close friend of mine, Daniel Taylor. And Daniel was the son and grandson of medical missionaries, and his father had actually been a good friend of Howard Somerville, who climbed with Mallory in 22 and 24. And that was the Everest of Daniel's imaginings, not the sort of ignoble or sordid scene of today with the commercialization of the mountain that had led to that loss of life.
Yes.
And Daniel began to speak of these wonderful Englishmen dressed in tweed who flung themselves against the snows of Everest and read Shakespeare to each other at 23,000 feet, and I became completely enamored. What interested me from the very start was not whether George Mallory got to the top or not, but what was the spirit that carried him on. And for those, in our audience who don't know the story, basically the British in 1921 set out on a reconnaissance to send a geographical expedition to even find Everest. They had to sort of walk 400 miles off the map to reach the base of a mountain that no European had ever come to close quarters with. And then in 22 and 24, having found the doorway to the mountain, they attempted to climb it. And famously on June 8, 1924, George Mallory, age 37, the most well-known climber in Britain, together with a young companion, Sandy Irvin, a terrific athlete from Oxford, were literally seen by a climber in support, Noel Odell, cresting a northeast ridge, going strong for the summit, when the mist rolled in and enveloped their memory in myth, and they were never heard or seen alive again. And there's always been a question in mountaineering as to whether they got to the top before they died, but I was always really interested in the energy or the spirit that carried them forward, and I had this sense from the very beginning that, both the Mallory and most of the companions on those expeditions were of the age and class that clearly they would have seen the fire of the Great War, World War One. And my thought was that perhaps they had seen so much of death that death had no mystery for them except that of their own, and that perhaps life mattered less than the moments of being alive. And not that they were cavalier about death, but they had seen so much of it that what mattered most was how one lived. And so that was sort of the idea I had. And so from the very beginning of the investigation, I wanted to find out where the men who went to Everest in those three expeditions, what they had experienced during the Great War. And the amazing thing about the Great War is that the British sector of the war zone was remarkably small. I mean, the British front was never longer than 125 miles, and behind that front they had 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. The Ypres salient, where, you know, 1.7 million young boys would die, you could walk around it. It was 4 miles by 12 miles. You could walk around it in a day or two. Mm-hmm. And because this sector was so small, because so many millions of men had gone through it, and because the British had so carefully chronicled every engagement, because there had been such an outpouring after the war of memoirs and diaries and journals and novels and various accounts, it was possible. There was literally no place in that battle zone that hadn't been chronicled in multiple voices in poetry and prose at virtually every day of the war. And so it was possible not only to trace where the climbers had been on a day-to-day basis, but also what they had experienced. And as I had anticipated, of the 26 climbers, two were too old. Sandy Irvin, famously too young for the war. Guy Bullock was a diplomat, and a man called Beetham set out the war as a schoolmaster. But the other 20 most assuredly did see the conflict. And they saw the worst of it. Six were severely wounded. Four as doctors dealt for 4 years and 4 months with the agonies of the dying and the dead. One, John Noel, famously, although he spoke for the rest of his life about his frontline service during the war, he actually set out the war in suicidal depression in a hospital, suffering from what Siegfried Sassoon famously called the twilight zone of hell, which was shell shock.
Yeah.
Two men lost brothers, and so on. So the war clearly had profoundly impacted the men. And so really the story of Everest, if it began as sort of a gesture of imperial redemption for an empire of explorers that had lost the race famously to the North and South Poles, it emerged in the wake of the war as a mission of regeneration for a nation bled white by war.
There's one guy, Charles Bruce. He had a pretty bad war, didn't he?
Well, he did. And you know, Charles Bruce is a great character. He was known as the Mad Mountain Maniac, and his favorite party trick was to rip a pack of cards in half. For casual exercise in India, he would put his adjutant on his back and run up the Khyber Pass. He was famous at the school of Harrow for having been thrashed as a schoolboy more times in a shorter period of time than any schoolboy in the history of the institution. He was an extraordinary character, and at Gallipoli, in an attack, he was mortally wounded almost. Machine gun fire practically severed the legs from his body, and he was told to retire to England and lead a gentle, quiet life, and above all, never walk uphill. Of course, that didn't stop him for a moment from trying to climb Mount Everest.
Yeah. And going back to the other people other than Mallory, that must have been great fun to discover things like Bruce's injuries and the sort.
Well, I mean, it took a lot of research, but it was, yeah, I mean, Mallory in a sense has overshadowed the other people on the expedition, and interesting as Mallory was, the other men are equally fascinating, One of my favorites was an unsung Canadian hero, the first Canadian, in fact, on Everest, Oliver Wheeler, who was a surveyor, seconded to the expedition by the Survey of India, and Oliver Wheeler had the hardest task of all. He spent more time, higher on the mountain, exposed to the wrath of the winds, and alone with his porters and his companions, but not with any English companions than anyone. And it was Oliver Wheeler, not George Mallory, who found the doorway to the mountain. It was Oliver Wheeler who found the route up the East Rongbuk to the east face of the North Col, the key to the entire adventure. And that's one of the things that the book properly does, is reestablish that this was a man who actually found it, the first Canadian on Everest.
Now, Mallory's, I guess, legend in history and popular culture is partly because of his disappearance, his death on Everest. Was he well known prior to this? I mean, my understanding is
No, he wasn't. I mean, he was just a schoolmaster. He had graduated from Cambridge. He went on to teach at a Charterhouse. He was a pretty incompetent teacher in certain ways. He was inspiring in other ways, but he had no interest in being a schoolmaster all of his life. He was an aspiring writer, but not that great a writer. And in fact, he first went to Everest somewhat reluctantly in 1921, but encouraged to do so by his mentor, Geoffrey Winthrop Young, because it seemed at the time to be a good career move. And then gradually, as the mountain possessed him, if you will, and as he came back from the mountain and was one of the best public speakers, and so he was sort of picked out by the Everest Committee to personify the effort, and he worked ferociously hard to do so. And of course, John Noel, who made films both in 1922 and 1924, you know, Mallory famously on the mountain complained to Noel that he hadn't gone to Tibet to become a film star, but he really had. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Noel's films did was sort of take and elevate Mallory into the realm of the Titans.
And did he know for E.M. Forster?
Mallory probably met E.M. Forster. The person who really was very close friends with E.M. Forster on the expeditions was John Morris, who was the only openly avowed homosexual on the expeditions. He was a fascinating character. He was a transport officer in 1922. He was a young kid, who did not respond to the patriotic fervor in 1914. As he put it, it was boredom alone in his job as a bank clerk that led him to enlist, and a class structure impossible to deny that had him elevated, as he put it, against all military logic, into the ranks of an officer. He tried to lose his virginity on the eve of going to France, and he slipped into the room in Nottingham with a prostitute. Then he fled in terror, and even though he had not shed his trousers, he was convinced that he had contracted some foul disease. He liked the delicate sounds of Debussy. He was a poet and a great musician. Could barely see. He was almost blind, but in the trenches he never failed to kill. And what really saved him in the end was that he responded to the possibility of being recruited into the Indian Army, and that otherwise, statistically, he, like all of his friends that began the war, he would have been dead. You must remember that 10,000 young officers were needed every month just to replace the litany of the dead.
Yeah.
And he went off to fight in India, in fact, and not a month before he joined the 1922 expedition, John Morris was on patrol in the Northwest Frontier when his command was ambushed by tribesmen, and many of them were wiped out, and he fought his way through back to the safety of the fort, and as he's glancing into the setting sun, he, with the vultures swirling overhead above the dead, he notices a figure stumbling out of the sunset, and it turns out to be one of his own men who's been flayed alive. His testicles are hanging by sinew at his knees, and he collapses into Morris's arms, and within a month, he's at the Everest Hotel as General Bruce bursts into the room.
Yeah. The I mentioned Forster because I've read that Mallory was the model for Mr. Emerson in a room with a View.
That's right.
Yeah. The relationship with the Tibetans, with the Sherpas, that's something that we read in this book. Is this a first in all the
well,
books
the
on Everest?
Well, the interesting thing, a lot of people sort of you know, say how the Sherpas have been overlooked in Everest mountaineering history. And I think that's true in contemporary climbing experiences. But the interesting thing is that the Sherpas were not mountaineers. They were simply people who came from Solukhumbu. There's a lot of misinformation about Everest. You know, you hear people speak of Shomalungma as if the mountain in Tibet, its name means goddess mother of the world. It's simply not true. There's no ethnographic or historical reality to that. And people talk about the Rongbuk Monastery as having been built in time immemorial. Well, the truth is that Everest itself was not a particularly sacred mountain, which is one of the reasons the Sherpa were fine with climbing it, because its deities had been tamed by Guru Rinpoche, the individual, the legendary Padmasambhava, who transmitted the Dharma, the Tibetan religion, the Buddhist religion to Tibet. But the environs of the mountain were all mystic space, and that's something the book sort of unveils. And people who speak about Rongbuk as an ancient monastery, it actually was a monastery that was built by a charismatic lama in the first decade of the 20th century, based on the wealth that had been secured in Solokhumbu, in Nepal, after the British had introduced the potato in the 1870s. So, you know, this was a very dynamic society, and so one of the things I tried to do in the book was to tell the story from the Tibetan side as well, and that's why I went and spent so many months in the monasteries and why I secured the spiritual autobiography of Zetsu Rinpoche, the legendary abbot of Rongbuk, and had it translated for the first time by scholar monks in Kathmandu. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the Sherpas is that they very much had a symbiotic relationship with the British. And in the early days, it was the British who brought the Sherpa to the mountain and trained them in the very skills of climbing on ice they would not have had on their own in their traditional culture. And it was that skill set that set them apart, and in the end would be sort of the foundation of both their fame and their fortunes. And then, so if in later years Sherpa have been neglected in the literature, and their role until relatively recently has been undervalued, in the early days, it's undoubtedly true that the British elevated the Sherpas into the realm of climbers by teaching them how to deal with rock and ice.
Was Mallory and these climbers, were they the first to use oxygen to go up the mountain?
Yes, absolutely. And it was a big debate between the so-called traditionalists, many of whom were old men in London who had never climbed anything taller than their desks, and the more you know, scientifically inclined of the climbers, like Howard Somerville or particularly George Finch, the Australian, who saw oxygen as no more of an artificial aid than, you know, doing your best to get a good pair of boots. Yeah. And so throughout those expeditions, oxygen, which had been shown its value in the first war, of course, for pilots, and there was always this tension between whether or not it was sporting to use oxygen. And it was actually a more complicated story because there were big mysteries. I mean, nobody knew what would happen, for example, if you climbed 28,000 feet using supplemental oxygen and, say, the apparatus broke down. Would you survive that? People simply didn't know. And this really, it's important to remember that to climb Mount Everest in 1921 was to go into a zone of death, in a way, and a landscape so austere that it was, you might as well have been going to the moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How far have you gone up yourself?
Well, I never, in this particular book, had any interest in climbing Mount Everest. I've explored all the flanks of the mountain, up the Rongbuk, around, all through the Karta Valley and the Gamachu, past all three passes into the Gama, gone down the Arun. But, you know, I really wanted to explore the approaches to Everest, but I never had any particular desire to climb the mountain. I didn't want this book in any way to be about me. I wanted it to be strictly about the men who, with such courage, flung themselves against the mountain.
How different is the Everest of today from that which they saw in the 20s?
Well, I think it's different in so many ways. I'm not casting any aspersions on climbers today who want to find themselves on top of the mountain, but you know, it's become a commercial kind of a commercial
adventure.
Venture. I mean, yeah. You know, the mountain is literally riddled with corpses of people who have died at various times. Probably for every 10 people who have made the summit, someone succumbed and the bodies are left on the mountain. There have been some noble efforts recently to clean up some of the detritus and garbage abandoned on the expedition by the various climbers. But basically, in my opinion, it's become a little bit of a carnival where, and this is in part because Everest is not a technically challenging mountain. It's not an easy mountain. I mean, it's really all about your fitness, your response to oxygen deprivation, the serendipitous coincidence of good weather, bad weather, and whether or not you can just have the fortitude and the will to struggle up the mountain. And so it attracts an awful lot of people that you would never find, for example, on a technically challenging mountain like K2. And because of that, and because it is the biggest, and because it's sort of become this sort of coveted goal, you have simply hundreds of commercial parties and a kind of traffic jam at the top of Everest. And I'm not casting judgments on that, but it's certainly a very different world from the time when Mallory and his comrades literally had to walk off the map and walk 400 miles across Tibet just to find the mountain.
My understanding is the book took, what, 12 years of research?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When they found Mallory's body in 1999, did you have any doubts about where this book was heading?
Well, absolutely. I mean, because I had signed this contract with Knopf in February of 1999, and I hadn't anticipated anything like a 10-year effort, but once the body was found, which was electrifying news, mm-hmm. There were, as I anticipated, I think a final count of maybe 10 books that came out within the year. Mm-hmm. And because of the nature of my interests, I needed to do a lot of research, and I actually went back to the publisher and offered to give back the book advance, and they very kindly said to me at Knopf, "We didn't give you all that money for a book on Mallory. We wanted a book by you on Mallory, so get on with it." And I sort of flippantly said it's going to take a decade, but it actually did, because I mean, it was kind of a blessing, because I instantly was forced to take the story to a level of breadth and depth that I had never anticipated, And I, frankly, at the time, it was rather daunting, because I had no idea, after all, at least superficially, with 10 books out on the subject and, perhaps 3 or 4 others that had been published earlier. I mean, what more remained to be said about this story? But nevertheless, I set out to tell it, and because I had a unique perspective on it, I think both because of my interest in the war and my perspective as an anthropologist, and I was able to, with the help of a wonderful military researcher, Roger Barrington, in England, and also a great friend and colleague, Carol Dunham, an anthropologist and Buddhist living in Tibet, I was able over the years to sort of take the story to a place that's never been. I mean, here's a 650-page book. Every single page, almost every paragraph, has some new information on it, dramatically new information, mm-hmm. and there's not a bit of poetic license in the book. If I mentioned that at some particular camp they ate mustard greens, it's because they ate mustard greens.
The finding of Mallory's body, did that answer any more questions, or did you just have more questions?
Well, it actually
to ask?
Didn't. It answered certain questions. I mean, some people had speculated. The big challenge on that final day was the second step. We know that from the discovery of an oxygen bottle, Mallory and Irvin reached the first step. In other words, the first of the impediments on this northeast ridge, and they clearly could have turned the first step or gotten over it. The question is, could they have scaled the second step, which is at one point place has a kind of 120-foot virtually vertical pitch of rock with tremendous exposures, 10,000 feet down to the Kanchung face on one side, 9,000 down to the Rongpa Glacier on the other. And, there was one speculation that Mallory might have left Sandy Irvin, because if Mallory could have scaled that, it's highly unlikely, however, that Sandy could have done it. There was some speculation that Mallory might have left Irvin at the base of that and gone on his own, but of course the discovery of his body with a rope, tattered rope, frayed rope around his waist, suggested what most people had already thought, that Mallory would never have abandoned a young climber on a mountain. The challenge is that not just getting up the second step, but getting down the second step. Most contemporary climbers, for example, rappel down from a prominent boulder at the very heights of it. Well, Mallory's ropes were neither strong enough nor long enough to do that. And there are any other lines of evidence. I mean, Mallory had lost their stove, so they hadn't been able to melt ice, so they were severely dehydrated when they even began the climb. They left their torches behind in the tent, so that suggests they may have started at dawn, when we know that Conrad Anker, who found the body and that did scale the mountain in 1999, he and Dave Hahn set out at 2 in the morning and still didn't get back to their high camp from the summit till 9 p.m. Any number of lines of evidence suggest Mallory probably couldn't have gotten up and probably got to the base of the second step, came back down, and then had their fatal accident. There is one intriguing possibility, however, and that is that if the snows so unusually and so densely buffeted the expedition in 1924, forcing Colonel Norton to abandon both the North Col camp and even Camp 3 at the base of the North Col, not once but three times over the course of that climbing season, had those snows accumulated on the northeast ridge with similar kind of depths, it's possible that a cone of snow fell, formed, over the second step, essentially turning it into a ramp, as indeed happened in the autumn of 1985. And if that had happened, it's not inconceivable that Mallory and Irving could have simply walked up the incline with the same sort of speed with which Odell famously reported their making toward the summit. And if that had happened, I think it's fair to say that nothing would have kept Mallory back, because, you know, for him and for that entire generation, life mattered less than the moments of being alive. He would have made it to the top.
Yeah. Now, you obviously can't write a book like this, in a decade or more in this case, without it affecting your life. I'm curious to know how it did. Were you inspired by these people at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, my own grandfather, was a doctor at a casualty clearing station behind the front. And, you know, whenever I've written a book, you know, writing is not easy. Hemingway famously said anyone who says that writing's easy is either a bad writer or a liar. And in order to maintain oneself over the months and sometimes years it takes to write a book, I think you have to have some kind of passionate sense of kind of justice or purpose or something you're trying to tell the world. And I think that all of us should remember what these men endured in this impossibly horrible war, because their sacrifices, you know, weren't insignificant, and they were our own grandparents, and in my case, and you know, there's a lesson there that should be carried forward that includes the thought that people should not casually slip into war, especially those who will not have the obligation to fight that war. I mean, you know, the Churchill famously said of the two world wars of the 20th century, he considered a single 30 years war, and he famously said never was a war less necessary to fight than the first or more essential to win than the second. So that kind of desire to share what these men of my grandfather's generation had endured for all of us is what motivated me to write the book.
Finally, Wade, in the acknowledgments or in the annotated bibliography, you mentioned that this all began after buying three books at a used bookstore in Vancouver. I'm curious which one that was.
Well, it was McLeod's, McLeod's bookstore. And I went to say hello to Don, and he was at the till, and I just glanced behind his head and saw, my God, they were the first edition of the 21, 22, 24 expeditions. I bought them, and they became the first acquisitions of a research library that would grow to 600 volumes.
Yeah. How much time do you spend in B.C.?
Oh, lots. Every summer I'm there for 3 months, you know.
Yeah. But home is in Washington, is it?
Well, part of the time. I mean, I haven't been at home in, I mean, probably 4 nights since August 28th.
Yeah. Wade, this is such a wonderful book and such a fine achievement. It's been great talking today. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
The book is called Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest. It's published by Knopf. It's author Wade Davis on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.